What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Future-proof extra from News Talk.
Now, in this increasingly digitized world, it's all about making fast things faster and even more efficient. And this is no more exemplified than in the field of computers. Things could be getting a lot faster, though, now, as an international team has discovered a new molecule that could give computers an extra boost. Here to tell me about the discovery is Professor Damien Thompson. He's from the Department of Physics in the School of Natural Sciences at University of Limerick. Damien, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Before we get into this molecule, what sort of computers are we talking about? Are we talking about these quantum computers that everyone's been talking about?
No, these aren't quantum computers. No, they actually work based on quantum mechanics, and we will probably get to that. But they're not quantum computers. They're just very, very small computers.
Okay.
So they did work for, say, ultra-dense computing, the type of large-scale computing we need to go behind the Internet of Things to power the world around us. So we need ultra-high-density computing, and for that you need very, very small components. That's what these are. These are miniaturized electronic components.
Okay, and so this is for then everyday computing as opposed to let's try and predict the weather for the next 5 years using very complex algorithms, and so we needed a giant supercomputer to do that. You're talking about dense computers that would be deployed across the world for lots of different things.
Yes, they're the things for the Internet of Things. That's what they are. The little computing gizmos that power that.
So obviously with the proliferation of the Internet of Things, with 5G, we now have the ability to put tiny computers in almost anything and have them communicate with each other. And this is done through chips and computing power. Before we go into that molecule, would you just maybe give a very short explanation of how conventional computers make decisions and compute?
So imagine now our tiny smartphones. So there we have those now. We have these incredibly functional small devices, basically because electrical engineers are so good. They're so good at building tiny circuits, but they're still not down to the scale of molecules. And when they make these circuits, each node in the circuit is set, so it can't be changed. They're binary. They're on or they're off. So they're just a series of switches. That's what an electrical circuit is. So what we're trying to do now in our research at UL is that we're trying to reimagine how circuits might look like. So reimagining how we might be able to embed complex logic, so yes, no, true, false, in tiny molecular components. So not just yes and no, but all the if and else, definitely maybe type decisions that we make in our brains. And we're doing that by playing with molecular scale materials properties, so playing with molecular crystals. So we find when we zap these crystals for this particular molecule, we get what's called a decision tree. So it traces out this beautiful pattern that looks just like kind of the decision making that we make inside our neocortex. That's the part of our brain where we think and what separates us from the lower beasts. So we can actually make these. So when we interpret that electrical signal that we get from the molecular crystal, we get all those logic gates built in. So we get if, else, and all that what's called Boolean logic. So that's what underlies computing, decision making essentially. So this molecule can do that. To our absolute amazement, it can do that.
What is this molecule we're talking of?
So the molecule, what it is, it's a little iron atom surrounded by organic rings. That's all. It's just 77 atoms big. It doesn't look particularly exciting. It's just another organometallic molecule. But the way in which the electrons are shared between that little iron atom and the rings is very strange. You break symmetry all over the place, and you get this complex pulling between the metal and the rings, which allows the electron to sit in lots of different states. And we can actually then, by charging up the molecule, by zapping it essentially with voltage, we can flip the electrons into lots of different states. And the complexity of that then is what maps out that decision tree for us.
Okay, so I guess traditionally you've got the flip of a coin, on or off, yes or no, true or false. And so in a switch, you can only have those two states. And what you're saying is with these iron atoms, you can flip them to be one of maybe like a die, six-sided, which gives you a multiple number of different choices for you to be able to make a much more complex problem solved in a much shorter space.
Yep. So that's the idea. I mean, current computers, they separate data storage from processing. So that's inefficient. It slows down the computer. It's the basic architecture of a computer. You do everything in different places. So next generation computers could solve that by being modeled on the human brain, which naturally makes it more energy efficient. So in the new device that we've made, this little molecule, everything is done in one place. So there's no need to keep reading or moving information around. So that removes that time lag between fetching the numbers and crunching them, which is a problem that's always plagued computing. So that, or the new molecular circuitry that we developed, means the computer processing unit no longer has to fetch data for every operation it performs. And that then saves enormously on time and energy costs. So it's a new way of doing it.
Okay, so people might be familiar with this. You're talking about the von Neumann
Yes.
bottleneck, the
Yeah.
where you've got your processor and then you've got your storage, which people might think of like your external disk, maybe in the old days before computers became more integrated. So to answer a problem, you got to feed the problem into the processor and then feed the data back out and then feed in the next bit of data and back out. So this constant going back and forth of the data. And if you're talking about large amounts of data, you're then hampered by the speed of those connections, but also the amount of data that can be read at one time, the speed of the transfer, as well as the amount of data you have to go through.
Yes. So our data, what we see when we zap this molecule is that we can make decisions using fewer computation steps with much smaller size devices. So these are like a nanometer across. That's 1 billionth of a meter. So that speeds up the decision making and it reduces the amount of heat produced by the device. So that's obviously very important if you want to do high density computing. You want to minimize the amount of heat that's produced. They're low power, they're very fast and very small.
So is that then a sort of decentralized computing in a way, rather than having one central processing unit, you might have like hundreds or thousands of these smaller chips. Is that the idea?
Yeah, just like the brain. And then when you do that, then you also get redundancy and reconfigurability. So the machine, if you have this distributed computing network, not every node has to work in the same way every time. So you get kind of a tolerance built into the system. And we need these types of highly accurate, reliable, high density computing if we want, say, to have all our data backed up to the cloud, and we want to be able to quickly send and receive data on those tiny computers that we still call phones for some reason. And we want everything to be instant. And of course, we'd really rather our phones didn't go on fire when that's happening. So these types of, ultra efficient, tiny components, reliable components, are what's needed to actually allow that.
How do you go about, I mean, this, by the way, I should have said at the beginning of this piece, Damien, that famously on this program, electricity is my magic. I just do not understand, even though it's been explained to me many times on the show. But how do you come across a molecule like this? Like, what is the process by which you go, oh, you know what? We can use this and it can give us five different states, which multiplies exponentially the computing power compared to a normal switch. Do you just fire energy at lots of different molecules, or what's the process?
Well, Louis Pasteur said chance favors a prepared mind. So I suppose we do our homework and we try to understand physics and engineering and chemistry and everything else as best we can. But yeah, it does boil down to then trying lots of different molecules. We kind of had a hunch this one might work because we've been working on this for quite a long time. So I work with the group in Singapore, also in India and the US on this. So it's big science. There's lots of us working on this together. I do mainly the modeling. Then there's other people who do the experiments, do the electrical engineering and everything else. We work together and we talk a lot and we spend half our lives emailing each other with mad ideas. But yeah, so we've been through, this is probably maybe the 10th molecule we've looked at. But we did not expect it to do the trick that it did. We really didn't. And it took us a long time to actually figure out what the data was telling us. When this paper was published, we briefly excited Twitter because of not because we've made an organic brain, but because of the size of the paper. So it was published in Nature, and we had a typical main text article, which is meant to be sort of chatty and to the point. And then we had supporting information, which came to about 100 pages. So we produced a huge amount of controlled experiments and models, basically to convince ourselves what we were seeing was real. So yeah, it was very exciting. And I think like all good science, it started with what on earth is this? And then once we all got together and thought about it, and eventually we made sense of it. But it started with the, oh my God, what on earth is this?
So what does that mean then? You've discovered a way to have a more distributed, almost neural network way of processing rather than a main central processing unit. What does that mean in terms of, for example, Moore's law, that famous, inverted commas rule that computers will get cheaper and faster every, well, 12 months, 18 months, depending on who's talking about it. And what does that mean for Moore's Law? Will that help make faster, smaller computers into the future?
Well, they also double in cost every 18 months, and that's the dark side of Moore's Law. But I guess silicon computers, so they hit a bottleneck when you get down to the nanometer level. So that's the 1 billionth of a meter, or 100th, say, the size of E. coli. And that's because even the best state-of-the-art semiconductor logic circuits, they're based upon and limited by just one simple trick. So from an iPhone to the supercomputers that NASA uses to watch the skies, every computer is based on just switches. We call them digit threshold switches. They're hardwired to perform logic functions. So the functions are defined as zero is false, one is true. So it's clean digital logic. There's no gray area. So they don't look at all like the type of complex decision making that we need, say, for neural networks, for distributed computing. So we were moving more away from that kind of zero and ones to a more kind of analog way of looking at circuits. That's the idea behind it.
I mean, if we look at commercial chips now, how far away is your sort of research to being in an Intel chip or in an Apple chip or in whoever makes the IoT chips that we're using at the moment?
It's quite close. I mean, we did a lot of, I mean, we were pushed to get the paper published. We were pushed to do a lot of experiments on actual applications of it. Like, I mean, that is often you see it with science. I mean, you get this Friday afternoon experiment where something mad happens and, you know, it's never been seen before. Whereas with this, we actually did spend months doing it over again. We did our best to actually get rid of that crazy decision tree signal, and we couldn't get rid of it. It was an inherent property of material, and we did many control experiments to prove that. And we work, for example, with researchers from Hewlett-Packard AI Research Lab. They're co-authors on the paper. So there are actually people like making circuit designs and depositing circuits as we speak, based on this architecture. So it is it's ready to go. I mean,
ready to go. But this sort of architecture is completely different to how we make chips now. I mean, are the manufacturers now going to completely think how they rehouse this sort of distributed network of chips? Do they need to?
Well, no, we'll always have silicon computing. I mean, these can go where silicon can't. So we must, for example, if we want sensors, say, Internet of Things, they must work properly, even when there's limited power sources or when the power connection is loose or cutting out. So I know you said you don't understand electricity, but the idea that, you know, we were talking about Christmas and the electricity grid might go down in Ireland, for example, we get blackouts. So I think that's something that everybody can appreciate. So you can imagine if you're a little autonomous sensor at the edge of the internet and you need to give a reliable answer all the time, you're not always going to have a constant power supply. You could be in water, you could be, say, down a mine.
Yeah.
So just like ourselves and our poor brains, they have to muddle through in the chaotic real world. So that's what these guys do. So they're agile, they're adaptable, and they're this difference makers, as we know, to survive in the real world. So our little molecule is proof of principle that these types of wildly new and unconventional circuit designs can work.
Do you think we need this sort of technology to tackle harder problems? I mean, in terms of AI, does this multi-node computing map better to the sort of problems that AI has to solve?
Yeah, so we want to make kind of a brain-like computer. So we want to take that architect, basically the layout and the architecture of a neocortex, so map that onto chips. So to do that, we need to embed and encode complexity that's far beyond what's will ever be possible, say, with silicon fabrication technology. So that's what Intel, Dell, and all the other people use. So for us, silicon is out and molecules are in. So our work is demonstration of what can be done by those molecular scale computers. And we're excited because the devices show all the hallmarks of brain computing. First of all, a huge number of tiny, identical molecular processors are networked together and work in parallel. But the most important part is that they show both redundancy and reconfigurability. So that means the device can solve problems even if the individual components do not work perfectly all the time or in the exact same way every time. Just like our brains. You know, we know that, say, if someone goes blind, God forbid, other parts of their brain kick in and their hearing improves. So our little molecule shows those types of effects.
You're talking about brain plasticity there, which is a really cool idea that I suppose we see in networks, but to actually see them on individual chips is pretty cool. Can I ask you a question about the silicon? Is silicon, is that not a molecule as well? Or because you said we're going away from silicon into molecules, is it not silicon molecules that they use to make the switches of off and on at the moment?
Well, so there's two ways of doing it. There's top down and there's bottom up. So for top down, you just take a big lump of silicon and just keep whittling it smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually you get down to a few nanometers and That's the fundamental limit on the size of the feature that you can have in your circuit. So that's what Intel do. And they're absolutely brilliant. As electrical engineers, they can get down to these minute feature sizes just through clever engineering, clever processing. And the other way up is bottom up. So that's where you have kind of Richard Feynman's idea that you can write the Encyclopedia Britannica on a head of a pin. So if each piece of information, each node is a molecule, then you can fit an awful lot of information in a very small space. So that's why we use molecules, whereas silicon is a lump of stuff. It's like a silicon metal or silicon dioxide. It's a sheet. It's a 3D object, a large, it's a lump of material, if you like.
Right.
Whereas a molecule is the little worm thing, like say a water molecule, a methane molecule. These guys are 77 atoms big. They're just an iron atom with organic rings around it. So it looks completely different to silicon.
It sounds very exciting. Damien Thompson from the University of Limerick, congratulations on the paper. Really exciting stuff, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.